Can't Rhode Island get anything right? Why won't the Education Commissioner answer the only questions? Is growing income equality a sign of satisfaction? This is Last Impressions 32, and I'm Justin Katz. So doesn't it seem like Rhode Island's elite are just doing everything wrong? I wanted to stop myself this week posting on theoceanstatecurrent.com about the things, the various things. It seemed, even I felt almost like I was complaining too much, but there's just so much. I mean, one of the big, big ones, obviously, this week was the General Assembly returned to do more damage in an unusual autumn session of damage doing, and they passed the paid time off legislation, which forces all companies in Rhode Island with 18 or more employees to offer a government determined sick day benefit. And the Rhode Island Center for Freedom and Prosperity, for which I work as research director, put out the information that by our relatively quick estimate, we're talking a $49 million cost to this. Nobody else put a dollar sign on this. Nobody. No legislators. Nobody had any interest in figuring out how much this was going to cost businesses. And the key point of this was, of that dollar figure, is that the people who have to pay that are only actually a minority of businesses, because a majority of businesses already offer this benefit. And if you don't offer it now, there's some reason. Now, some of it might be, the progressives' vision of the greedy corporate miser who's got his Bob Cratchits to the grindstone, and they won't let them go home sick, and they have to sit there and cough on each other. That might be some of them, but I would imagine more of them, people who don't get this benefit, either they didn't want it, they negotiated for higher salaries, or it just doesn't really apply to the job. If you're a part-time employee who works from home, you get sick Monday, you just work Thursday when you usually don't work, or you that kind of thing. So those are the circumstances people are probably dealing with in reality. None of it matters to the legislature. Matt Allen on WPRO appeared on his show talking about this earlier in the week. He was playing clips from the debate, just astonished. I mean, it was legislating by anecdote. Like, I know a guy who got sick and he couldn't go home for work, and we just don't want that to happen. The whole thing is just a political show, and it really shows we're just not doing legislation right. And if you want to look more forward-looking to something that hasn't happened yet, we're looking at the PawSox Stadium they want to build in Pawtucket at the team's expense, they say, based on revenue. But the public's going to put up for the bond. Public's going to own, Republic meaning you and I, Rhode Islanders, is going to own the stadium with this rent. We rent to you, you rent to them, et cetera, et cetera. And then you give us the money as a lease and it's revenue. We're backing it. That's why they need us. That's why they can't go out and get these bonds on their own as a private organization. But they're having these show hearings for the Senate. And the Senate went on for 4 hours of scheduled hearings, and it could have been more. They actually stopped. They could have probably gone to 6 hours of hearings just on pro-stadium folks. It was just lined up. And so it was 10 o'clock before anybody who opposed it could even get to the microphone. And once again, they were the ones bringing actual arguments and data, not reading poetry about a love for baseball and that sort of thing. But these hearings are they don't want to go to ballot on this thing and have Rhode Islanders have a say, because they're afraid of what Rhode Islanders will say when they have a choice about how they spend their own money. But what they're trying to do, and it's so clear, is to make it appear that we're all getting our say, but not really. And that's, maybe if we keep pushing on them and it keeps not going through, they'll at some point say, you know what, just put it on the ballot and get a final answer. But until they have to, they're going to do all these show hearings where they the unions cancel their apprenticeship classes and your training for today is to go protest at the state house and all that kind of stuff to make it seem like we've got something democratic, something resembling representation. Maybe that's going too far, but it appears to be what they're trying to simulate here. And now nobody has done the "can't we do anything right" more, or raise that question more than Governor Gina Raimondo. I mean, hits just keep on coming. One of the recent ones is her name on all those blue roadwork sign signs around the state. Apparently, there are around 200 of them, costing some $234 each, or something to that effect. And so we find out now after John Vitkovec, I might be pronouncing his full last name wrong. After he had to go to the attorney general and get him to say, yes, governor, you have to give up this publicly available information about how much these signs cost. And they cost, as you might predict, about 100% more than they were listed as originally said they would cost, because, you know, that didn't include labor. So you were paying $100 for making the sign and installing it. And just a quick reminder here, I had a post on this on the Ocean State Current, and I don't want to spend much time on it here, but all that extra work for DOT employees comes after Peter Alviti, the head of the DOT, who was a former employee of the Laborers Union, changed around hiring plans to get rid of engineers and stuff they were going to hire, and instead of hire workers who are part of his union, naturally. And so he made that switch, and then they brought road painting, road striping, the lines in a road, they brought that in-house and bought some machines to do it themselves to create more work for a laborers union. And now apparently they still have plenty of time to sit around making signs and install them. But the federal government has said, you cannot do this with our money. You cannot put a political name on your signs. Well, there you go. Did we need the federal government to step in? Can't we have a higher ethical standard than the minimum required by the federal government? I mean, come on, people. Also, another thing the governor did this week was blurring the lines between roles. So she declared that the state of Rhode Island, she declared that nobody who's applying for DACA status, deferred action for childhood arrivals, that's illegal immigrants who came here as children, or were brought here, rather, she's declared that none of them will have to pay the $495 fee to reapply for the program, because she's worked with the Rhode Island Foundation and who knows who else to put together this fund to pay for it. But what's objectionable here, and we've seen this again and again with her, is this sort of it's like a shadow government where the governor has an official standing at a state of Rhode Island podium in the stateroom at the state house, has an official presentation about this program, which isn't a government program. She lists a bunch of other things we do to attract illegal immigrants to the state, you know, free and state tuition, that kind of thing, which are actual government policies. So there's this seamless impression that this is her administration doing this, but it's actually the Rhode Island Foundation, a private entity, and it's Governor Raimondo's political friends of Gina, PAC, I think, I'm pretty sure it is, putting out fundraising emails to put into the Rhode Island Foundation's account for this, and the governor in her official capacity presenting this. Now, this blurring of lines is completely inappropriate. We have lines for a purpose. There's a reason we want to know, are you acting as governor right now, or are you acting as a progressive private citizen? And of course, all of this is on top of UHIP disaster, getting the federal government warning us not to go forward with it, doing it anyway, and then the federal government getting not too happy with us. Again, can't we have a higher bar for minimum competence than the federal government requires? The DCYF, where you've got essentially the governor's administration hiring people not qualified and their children dying, and other not quite as extreme results. And then also this week, we find out that the governor's spending all kinds of money on PR. And that's where I want to branch off a little bit on this, because I did spend some pixels on this on OceanStateCurrent.com this week, talking about how it's not just, I mean, yes, Governor Raimondo has exploded the number of PR professionals in her administration and the cost, but she's also been preventing, it seems like, the policy has changed, you know, night and day when she came on board as governor. The professionals in government who know things about technical things, revenue, taxes, programs, other things, you used to be able to get in touch with them, and they would reach out and explain things to you. Now, much, much more likely these days, you'll be routed to one of these PR people to answer the question. So it has to go through the spin machine before you can get your answer. And often, as we've been finding, again, with John Vitt having to have looking to the roadwork signs and push the issue with that. This administration, Raimondo administration, has been a lot less transparent, a lot less willing to give out information. But one of the key things I've noticed is that the whole state government apparatus is pointing in the direction of narrative building and promotion of the governor. And that's, Stefan Pryor, the head of the Commerce Corp, who's an out-of-state Raimondo find, he can't even tell whether he's PR or has some other duty independent of the governor to do what's right for the people of Rhode Island. He's always promoting her in kind of an unctuous way. And also, I've been disappointed to find a similar kind of vibe around another of Raimondo's out-of-state finds, Ken Wagner, the education commissioner. Now, he was on Newsmakers recently with Tim White, Ted Nesi, and they had Dan McGowan join in, all WPRI reporters, Channel 12. And he didn't want to answer questions directly. And that's the problem. As I wrote on a current, it used to seem with Deborah Gist before, and then Peter McWalters, the prior education commissioner, you saw them on TV and they looked like they were there and it had a very Rhode Island feel because it's such a small place. You have this feel like you can talk to people, but they looked like when they were being interviewed, no, I understand what you're asking me and I'm going to try to answer it as well as I can. I mean, that was sort of the vibe. Now you get this vibe like, yeah, I probably know what you're asking, but I'm going to walk all around it and not actually give you an answer. And this is an important topic, so I wanted to spend some time in this podcast on this. So here's Ted Nesi's first attempt to get an answer from the education commissioner.
We put a lot of money into that funding formula. I think it's well over $100 million since the funding formula finally went in around 2010. What can you point to that shows that money, that was money well spent, and we've seen results from that big increase in the state investment in K-12?
Yeah. So the main part of the funding formula is to give predictability from year to year, so people who run school districts know what to expect from year to year. In terms of results, we've spent a lot of time over the last 2 years talking about a comprehensive agenda that's first of all anchored in relevance and rigor for kids. So we talk a lot about pathways and how to make sure that our system can organize around not only the needs of students to be prepared for college and the workforce, but also the interests of students so they're engaged and they work hard. We also spent a lot of time talking about foundations. So the governor issued a third grade reading challenge to make sure that we can address in a pipeline way students who are ready to read fluently and joyfully by third grade, so doors open for them in the rest of their lives.
So that whole answer was kind of predictable from the beginning, but I let it run because there are a few points to really catch, if you didn't catch them, to listen to and maybe even rewind and listen to it again. So the first one is as soon as Nesi's done with the question, the first sound out of Wagner's mouth is, yeah, okay, I understand your question. All right, I gotcha. I know what you're asking. You can trust me to give you your answer. No, not really. But the second part thing to listen to there is, everything he says is we've been talking about. So the question, what did we get for our $100 million? What have you done? What can you show us? What's the benefit? Where are our children making out better now than they were before? Well, you know, we've been doing a lot of talking. Okay. And what? Yeah, we talk a lot about this. Well, but what about score? Well, we talk about doing stuff for our kids, and I guess they never really get around to actually doing it. So maybe for $100 million, we're paying these people to sit around finding narratives. Is that basically, and thinking, you know, staring at their navels if they're allowed to pull their shirts up out of their pants or something like that in the office, and staring at their navels and trying to get inspiration about how to help kids. The last thing that caught my eye was, and because it came up, caught my ear rather, because it comes up multiple times in his interview, is the idea of reading fluently and joyfully. Fluently and joyfully. I mean, it sounds like something that's supposed to like hypnotize you, doesn't it? Whoa. We're trying to get our children to read fluently and joyfully. Joyfully. Well, we want our children to be joyful, I guess. So pay attention to that kind of language, because it's really, it's this whole, answering questions without answering them. Oh, we talk a lot about fluency and joyfulness. And that's, you know, what you're getting for your $100 million. So Nisi, being Ted Nisi, followed up and tried to get a more straight answer.
But you're talking about what we need to do next, but I'm asking about what we've done already. I mean, we were adding $25, $30, $35, $40 million a year to the K-12 spend through the funding formula transition over the last 7 or 8 years every year in the budget. So we can't spend on this. We've got to put it into the K-12 funding formula. What did that buy us?
So you've got to lay the foundation. So what that bought us is a comprehensive K-12 system that's based on predictability. We are continuing the standards-based instruction work that we started 6 years ago. The funding formula worked started around the same time as the standards-based instruction work. So we're continuing that work. We're continuing the work around holding adults accountable through comprehensive measures, like it was the park. Now it'll be a partnership with Massachusetts and a partnership with the College Board at the high school level. And then most importantly, we've laid the foundation for to take that work to the next level and really invest in leadership, the people in our buildings and our districts who are going to make all of that investment by Rhode Island taxpayers come alive for our kids and our families.
Translation. It bought us nothing. I mean, all that money, it was like the deposit you put on a large purchase. You don't get the thing. It's an intent. It's a show of faith to the vendor that they should hold on to it because somebody else isn't going to come back in and take it away. You know, somebody with better ideas or a better product. So I want to spend a moment talking about this idea of accountability because that word comes up a few times and it's supposedly one of the things we bought with our money, a foundation for accountability. Have you noticed it's never tied to any actual consequences? All right, so accountability. What's the consequence? A stern letter? A feeling of guilt? I mean, the question isn't how would you have a metric for accountability, but how are people actually being held accountable? And that's the key question here. So we've got all this stuff, all these foundations, supposedly, and our students are doing just as poorly on these standardized tests. There's no evidence that there's any improvement in any regard. And we're not holding people accountable. We're messing around with tests for whatever good that is. Hundreds of millions of dollars here, folks. I mean, we need straight answers on this so we can make decisions as voters. So now, After Ted had two tries, Dan McGowan attempts to salvage the question.
But just to continue that point, for all the money, the millions and millions of dollars that have gone to every district in the state, still more than half of the kids that are going to public schools aren't proficient in math or ELA. So why haven't we seen better results?
We clearly have more work to do, and it's not just about the education sector. One of the things that we hear all the time is when the governor and when Secretary Pryor is looking to grow our economy by bringing businesses in, people to bring their businesses in or grow their business, there is a perception, whether it's fair or not fair, accurate or not accurate, that our schools are not where they need to be. And that is not only affecting our kids, but it's actually affecting our ability to grow our economy. So this is something where we don't point fingers, we don't point blame at each other, but we all have to roll up our sleeves and do.
So there's your answer on accountability. Accountability means assigning blame. You can't just say we all have to roll up our sleeves. You took millions of dollars to do something. Where's the accountability? Who's at fault? Now, it's an open question. It really is. So you could come back and say, look, you know, parents have to step it up. In which case, we start to ask questions, well, should we change our resource allocation from education bureaucracy and put it in something that'll bring parents to maybe step up a little more? Maybe, you know, but we need to know. We need to assign blame. We can't just say, you know, we're being all accountable and stuff, but we're not going to blame anybody. It doesn't work that way. Now, so in summary, all that money, and Commissioner Wagner can't tell us what actual good has been accomplished for students now and families now, and he won't tell us who is doing what wrong. The vagueness of this all is like as if it's this brave education establishment fighting against mean fate. It's like some strange aura in the sky, and the only real solution is to do a dance about accountability and talk in real soft tones and maybe give children the supports they need, and it will, I don't know, what, lull the evil spirits to sleep, and maybe the kids will start actually learning math. I mean, you know, the impression you get is that these folks actually really sincerely in their hearts do believe that building a narrative is actually an action. And elsewhere in the interview, I think Wagner actually says something pretty close to that. We've been constructing a narrative. Well, no. Teach the kids. That's narrative, schmerative, right? The people of the state are not being served by their government, and specifically the Raimondo administration, and they should be outraged. And that's especially true in this case with talking education for those who can't afford private school or those who aren't like Education Commissioner Wagner, who has no children of his own. Folks, we're letting them get away with murder here. So I want to switch gears and turn to one of my favorites, Econ Talk, with Russ Roberts. And he was talking to an economist, very heavy French accent, so be prepared for that. I believe it's French. Gabriel Zucman. And they're talking about income equality and how it's grown in the United States. And I thought this part was interesting.
Despite important changes in government transfers and the expansion of some important programs like Medicare and Medicaid, that has not been enough to significantly lift the income of working class Americans, of the bottom 50%.
So to give some of the details of in the rest of the podcast, transfer payments, that's government giving people other people's money, transferring it, only slightly reduces the degree of income equality, or the growth of income inequality when you put it into Zucman's formula. Because it's the market growth, it's, you know, actual private sector income that has slowed in real terms, that is adjusted for inflation, for people on the lower half of the income distribution, which makes me wonder, you know, did redistribution, did all those important programs, as you call them, slow economic growth? I mean, would maybe if we got rid of some of that, maybe it would increase economic growth, and that would go to the people who are now being given handouts. One, Russ Roberts, the host of the show, he makes one of the obvious points that, you know, population changes. He derails because he uses immigration as his example. But you know, you start with maybe, you know, maybe the group that's at the lowest was at the lowest 20 years ago, advanced and was replaced by another low group. So if you look at over time, follow one family, for example, they'll move up, so they can get that mobility. Now, Roberts and Zucman go back and forth on that, and it's mixed results. But what I started to, that is, it's still true that people can advance, but it's an open question on whether they can do so as much as they used to be able to. And I think they cannot, because largely because of government regulations and that sort of thing. But the new question that made this Econ Talk worth bringing up here was, you know, it made me start to wonder, some people might even be offended at this question, but what if the bottom 50%, realizing we're talking about a moving target, but what if the fifth half of the country at any given time is, you know, kind of satisfied being in the lower half of the income distribution? I mean, that would allow for the opportunity to advance. That would allow for that to still exist and be active and a real part of the American experience. But, you know, maybe 50% of people in any given generation will be satisfied and not strive to get to the next level. And if that's the problem, a lot of the solutions we pursue, like education, aren't going to help. I mean, I bring up all the time my friend's disappointment. He had expected, I probably say this every other week, but because I think it's a good illustration of a lot of things I talk about, but he had, you know, when he was younger and naive, he thought as we became a wealthier society with more free time, people would devote themselves to higher pursuits because they're more interesting, like the meaning of life. But they turned instead to reality TV. The only thing that would help if the problem is a sort of a satisfaction is giving people motivation, which is pretty much the opposite strategy to what we try under a generally progressive government. Now, what do I mean? Motivation. The first thing that may come to mind on that count is the idea of a negative motivation. Take care of people less, take away the social safety net, make sure they can't get on disability as easy, make sure they can't stay on welfare for as long, especially if they're not working. That kind of thing. Don't keep trying to ratchet up the benefits they get for not working or for being poor to the point, because as the articles you come across often, there's a cliff now where people get so much from the various programs, both in cash and services, that if they work, they have to make something like $60,000 out of the gate to get back to the same level of real, actual spendable money and services that they were enjoying before. And that's a relatively new problem, at least to the extent that keeps people from working. And that's part of what makes them satisfied. So part of motivating them can be that negative, that take that away, and then they'll be motivated to get off the couch and turn off the reality show and go get a job, because now they're not comfortable or as comfortable as they were. But, you know, motivation can also be positive. And I'd say government has also been failing in this regard. And that's give people more to work for. Encourage family growth and children and higher aspirations. That will motivate them. And part of that is, you know, not letting families dissolve so easily. Divorce, not letting divorce be such an easy thing to get. Cultivating that natural inclination to take care of your family and to work and have aspirations and look to the future. That's what America used to be about. This week I also posted on, I guess you would say, early indications that advocates are starting to try to set the groundwork to pull government into a war on loneliness and make it a public health issue that requires naturally tons more government spending, with probably with a lot of talk and narrative building and systems of accountability. But that seems to be pretty related to this, both in the causes and in mutual effects. I mean, if we take away, my point in the post on the Ocean State Current was that if we take away the incentives to have children and stay married and take care of your own parents, partly by supporting them without you, so it takes that burden off you, right? To go, you can go work because we're taking care of your children, and when you're grown up, we're taking care of your parents through Medicare and other aid to elderly folks. So that reduces the need for that familial bond. And it also, you know, if people are getting depressed from that, that could be why they're satisfied not making much money. That's why they don't have those higher aspirations. They're lonely. They're taken care of enough that they can wallow. I'm being overly, you know, controversial, I guess, in a way. I'm provocative in the way I'm talking about this. But you see what I mean? How we're disconnecting people from a sense of reality and human nature. Now, Zucman obviously doesn't go in that direction. He follows essentially a progressive line on what policies have affected the income inequality in the country.
So I think what's more important to as an explanatory factor for understanding what has happened in the U.S. is not low-skill immigration, but it's a number of changes to policy. The decline in the real federal minimum wage since the late 1960s or 1970s, the big decline in the role of unions, more broadly speaking, the decline in the bargaining power of labor, very unequal access to higher education. All of these things, I think, have contributed to the stagnation of bottom 50% income in the U.S.
So, you know, there it is. That's why do we have income inequality? Well, the minimum wage hasn't gone up relative to the inflation. You don't have anyone much by way of unions. It's private sector unions are on a decline. It's almost entirely a government activity now. And, you know, the labor has lower bargaining power and higher education. It's, people aren't being educated. So these are pretty standard progressive responses. But I don't know. To me, they don't hold up. I mean, mostly because they don't answer the proper questions. I mean, for one, higher education, for example, higher education is more accessible than ever. Now, the question here is saddling people with debt after college, which that should be motivating them more. I don't know why it isn't, but not accessibility. We're getting them there. We're just making them pay for it. So, and I don't think that doesn't appear to be intimidating people as much as maybe it should, the fact that they have to pay. And by the way, the big news, CCRI in Rhode Island, Community College of Rhode Island, is booming because of free tuition. Well, gee, who saw that coming? But anyway, the bargaining power question, the bargaining power of labor, why are they losing that power? It's not policy. And, you know, frankly, I think the first two, minimum wage and unions, are part of the same question. Why isn't the minimum wage a stronger political issue? I mean, if people were really suffering, that would be an easy sell for politicians. Or why aren't more workers looking for unions? It's not for lack of the ability of unions to promote themselves and get votes. They're actually not getting people to sign up. I mean, is it Volkswagen? I think in Tennessee, the company is actually trying to get the workers to unionize because that's what they're used to, is that dynamic. And the workers keep saying, no, thank you. So why? It's not that we're not taking bargaining power away from them from that framing from Zuckman. They're giving up bargaining power. Now, of course, some of this could be coincidence with the change in our industrial mix. So, you know, manufacturing goes elsewhere because it's less expensive, and unionization kind of goes down naturally because manufacturing is one area where the benefit of collectively bargaining is more clear cut. But, it could also be another indication of a sort of a comfort level. Are people comfortable where they are? That would explain why they're not fighting for minimum wages, joining unions, giving up bargaining power, etc. And, you know, those who aren't comfortable nowadays are going to be more likely to be those who see the minimum wage as a cost, because they'll be trying to start businesses, and that'll be a preventative to that. Or they'll see collective bargaining as a restraint. You know, some that they have to, they'll only get as high a pay as the company will negotiate for everybody, right? They can't individually go out there and get more out of their own merits. And the upshot is that all of these things require a sort of subtle balance, and government just cannot manipulate the knobs at such a fine level, because it messes one thing up, gets another thing right, but then something else falls apart, and then tries to layer on layer after layer of new restrictions and dictated policies that people have to find, and new ways to go out and cure loneliness, because now that, because of some prior decision, people are more lonely than ever. I don't know. I guess the moral of this all, we don't want people to suffer, but we also don't want them slipping into complacency. And that's the solution is, you know, don't try to micromanage it. I think we've lost a kind of a wisdom. to, in essence, you know, leave it to God. I mean, we help people, yes, improve their lots, yes, but insulating them from the world is not our responsibility. I mean, even in doing so, we even interfere with their sense of reality. They're not interacting with the world as they should, as the world really is. You know, when I first started working at a college, within a couple of years, I was editing high-tech market research in a cubicle. And as I've said before, the design on the cubicle walls was like, it reminded me of as if somebody were in a cave marking the days that they'd been stuck. And that's how it felt. And I thought about how many steps from anything actually natural. I mean, here I was editing text about technology, which is not, I mean, it's an abstraction of the material objects that the technology is manipulating to produce itself. It just felt so distant from the natural world. And I think that's a good metaphor for the society we're constructing. We're putting all these pads between people and reality. And reality in this case is ultimately, in my view, synonymous with God. And people aren't making decisions that are right for them. They're interacting in this artificial reality of soft talking jargon and other people going to solve your problems. And it's dangerous. It's very dangerous. So let me remind you, these podcasts are now on iTunes. So even if you get them off theoceanstatecurrent.com, which you should visit daily for sort of daily impressions. But if you go to iTunes and search for Last Impressions or I think Justin Katz, you'll find it. You know, rate it. I hear that makes it go up in the rankings and other people can find it and hopefully learn or enjoy it, one or the other, maybe both. And that's it for me for this week. See you next week for, you know, impressions in real time. Have a good one.